This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland. Celebrating the 4th of July more than 200 years after Americans won their independence from England, it's easy to overlook how complex the Revolutionary War was and how shifting loyalty could be. Nobody represents that complexity, that shifting, more than a brilliant and determined general who saved the American cause on at least one occasion, Benedict Arnold, whose name has become synonymous with treason. What made Arnold defect from the American cause and take up arms against his former comrades? We'll find out from Nathaniel Philbrick, New York Times best-selling author of The Heart of the Sea, Mayflower, The Last Stand, and Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. Welcome to University of the Air.
Oh, it's great to be with you.
And a pleasure to talk to you after delving into your wonderful book about those complexities of the American Revolution and those shifting loyalties. Let, I guess, start at the beginning of the formation of Benedict Arnold as a loyal American.
Yeah, well, he grew up in Connecticut. His great-great-grandfather had been a governor of Rhode Island, but his father fell on hard times, and he would ultimately end up in New Haven, where he was apprenticed to an apothecary, and would do very well there, become a seagoing merchant who would trade in horses and other goods and make his way down to the Caribbean regularly and then up to the St. Lawrence, to Quebec and Montreal. And so he had a real sort of global view of North America. And he was married, would ultimately have three kids when the Revolution broke out. And he was an ardent patriot and decided right from the very beginning that it was critical that the Americans have control of Lake Champlain. And so he and Ethan Allen would band together at the last minute and take Fort Ticonderoga. And that sort of began him as being one of the stellar performers in the early years of the Revolution.
Now, is this the attack on Fort Ticonderoga where there were just like a handful of British kind of sleeping in the
exactly.
fort?
Exactly, yeah. No one was really prepared for it. And Ethan Allen's Green Mountain Boys very quickly broke into the British liquor supply and got roaring drunk, much to the distress of Arnold, who actually took this quite seriously. And he would then get a loyalist sloop and work his way up the Lake Champlain and strike the British in the northern end of the lake. It's more than 100 miles long. It's a very river-like extending lake, and give America control of that very important waterway. And so, you know, he was just a hard-driving person who could inspire loyalty from his men, but could also anger other officers. He was not a very compromising sort of person. He was passionate, there was no one better in a crisis.
And if we look at the map here a little bit, the strategic aspect of Lake Champlain, as you mentioned, this waterway that goes all the way from New York into Canada and is navigable for much of its distance, that would have been really a perfect invasion route for the English to come down from Canada to take New York?
Right. And in fact, it was the only route because, you know, this was before there were really any roads in what was an absolute wilderness. And the only way in the 18th century to transport an army through that territory was by water. And so you had to do it by Lake Champlain and then to where Fort Ticonderoga was at the very southern tip of it, and then a slight jog to Lake George, and then a little overland, and you were on the Hudson River. And you could then take that all the way down to New York. So this corridor of water was absolutely essential in the strategy of the war. And if the British should get control of it, they would be in a position to cut off New England from the rest of the states. And that would, basically win the war for the British at the very beginning.
And what were the pressure points on Lake Champlain and on the Hudson? We have Ticonderoga, you've mentioned, but also West Point.
Yes, and then as you worked your way to the Hudson, Albany was the first big significant community, and then as you worked your way down and approaching New York, you'd get into the Hudson Highlands, and it was West Point where there was a bend in the Hudson, where a fort there could prevent any shipping from going either up or down. That would eventually become what we now know as West Point, and become the strategic American fortress that Arnold, as it so happened, would be destined to try to turn that fortress over to the British when he ultimately decided to defect. And so this corridor of water, this waterway, was absolutely essential not only to the strategy of the war, but to really Arnold's life, because it was at the beginning of the Revolution that he made his first big play at Fort Ticonderoga, and then it would be at West Point where you know, it would all fall apart when it came to his former loyalties to what had been his country.
Was West Point also occupied by loyal British troops?
There was no significant fort there when the Revolution broke out in 1775. It would really be Washington who recognized that it's absolute critical strategic value. And so in 1778 and 79, he would lead efforts to turn that fortress into the preeminent fortress in North America. And by doing so, he would, of course, contribute greatly to the security of America, but he also would create a fortress so important, so strategically important, that if it should fall to the British, it would have a truly devastating blow to America. And so, in one sense, by making this fortress so impregnable and so strategically important, Washington had a hand in creating the opportunity that Arnold would attempt to exploit in 1780.
But the British certainly had the advantage in numbers of disciplined military officers and men, and also in ships. And so the Americans had to act very quickly. And would this mostly put them in a defensive posture?
Absolutely. I mean, America was not prepared for this war when it happened. You know, how could they? And they were up against the Empire, one of the greatest armies in the world and the greatest navy in the world. And so, and you know, these were professional soldiers and sailors. There was nothing to correspond with that in America. And so you had people like Arnold, you know, an apothecary and a merchant, suddenly finding himself, you know, leading battles, attacking forts, and learning how to become a military leader on the fly. And so it's fascinating to watch, you know, who emerges from the American population to become the truly great generals. And I think I would argue that they're really, short of Washington and perhaps Nathaniel Greene and a handful of others, there was no one who was as good a battlefield commander as Benedict Arnold.
Well, the really impressive thing that he did early on, that battle at Valcour Island, where he needed a fleet. And so, I mean, it sounds as if they literally just chopped down trees, made boats, and attacked the British fleet.
Yeah, I mean, it's really one of the most spectacular accomplishments of the Revolution. And, you know, to set the scene, Washington has just lost New York to the British. So they have New York at the beginning of the Hudson River, and there is now a big invasionary force coming down from Canada, and the only person between to prevent Great Britain from taking back Fort Ticonderoga, taking control of that waterway and winning the war is Arnold. And Arnold has spent the summer literally creating a fleet by hacking ships out of the timbers of the forests around him at the southern tip of Lake Champlain in what's now known as Whitehall. He created a lake-going navy of 15 vessels, galleys and what were known as gondolas. And, you know, and these were basically overgrown rowboats with sails on them that could take between 40 and 80 men, equipped with cannons. And, you know, these were not the seagoing vessels. And Arnold didn't, most of his men had no sea experience. They were landlubbers. And so it was up to Arnold to try to prevent this mammoth armada coming down from Canada that included several schooners, a three-masted actual warship with 18-pound cannons on them. I mean, you know, all of this stuff. And so Arnold had a huge task, and he had to sort of figure out on the fly, and he would fight what is now known as the Battle of Valcour Island on the west side of Lake Champlain, just below modern Plattsburgh, where he would meet the British in Valcour Bay, just inside this little island. And it's one of the great little-known battles of the Revolution that had where he was able to fight the British to a draw and slow them down in their relentless, what looked to be a relentless move south to take Fort Ticonderoga.
Did Arnold receive any recognition for that holding action that was so successful?
Yeah, I mean, you know, he got some recognition, yes, and you know, already he had a reputation being built. He had helped take Fort Ticonderoga, and in the year prior to the Battle of Valcour Island, he had led a ragtag army through the wilds of modern Maine to Quebec won him the title of the American Hannibal. And although he was unsuccessful in taking that British-held city, you know, it was clear he was one of the foremost military personalities. And so you add the Battle of Valcour Island, in which he prevented the British from taking Fort Ticonderoga by a year, and thus saving America in 1776, you know, he was our highest-ranking brigadier general, and he quite rightly expected to become a major general once the winter came. And unfortunately, the Continental Congress, who were the ones who determined who would be Washington's major generals, decided not to include Arnold in those promotions, and thus would begin the bitterness that within 3 years would ultimately lead to his attempt to become a traitor.
Did he know George Washington before the war?
There's no evidence he knew George Washington before the war, but he did meet him quite early on, soon after Washington had joined what would become the Continental Army in Boston for the siege of Boston in 1775 and 76, and it was Washington who sent Arnold to Quebec on that expedition, and so Washington was clearly impressed by Arnold, and what he would do at Quebec and then at Valcour Island did nothing but increase that respect. And in fact, when Washington heard that Arnold had been overlooked to become a major general, he immediately wrote him a letter and said, "Look, I don't know what happened. You know, this is clearly politics. Don't get too upset. I'll see what I can do." And he, I think he had a real admiration for Arnold. I think there was also a side to Washington that kind of was envious of Arnold. Washington was 10 years older than he was. Arnold was in his mid-30s, and Washington was saddled by the weight of being commander-in-chief and really could not be, and he had a naturally aggressive temperament, which I think a lot of people are not quite aware of Washington did. And I think he very much would have loved to have been out there on the battlefield fighting those battles that Arnold was winning, but instead he was having to deal with Continental Congress. He was trying to keep this leaking ship afloat.
And trying to raise money all the time, too, I guess.
Trying to raise money. And, you know, what was frustrating for Washington, and Washington had more than his many frustrations with Congress as well. And, you know, we think of the victory at Trenton and Princeton, you know, after he lost New York and was forced to retreat across New Jersey to the other side of the Delaware. It looks like we might lose this thing. He leads the improbable victory that will become Trenton, then ultimately Princeton, and it's one of the greatest comeback of all times. And you'd think the Continental Congress, who were his boss, would have been thankful. And actually, it was quite the reverse. There were many in the Continental Congress, particularly people like John Adams from New England, who were concerned that Washington's increasing popularity might lead to a military coup. You know, if you looked at your history, every other revolution in which a republic was the intended result ended up failing because the military, whether it was Caesar, whether it was Cromwell in England, became so sick of the legislature's inability, the civil government's inability to get things done, that they took control of matters in their own hands. And so there were people in Congress who feared, you know, Washington was a candidate for exactly that. We now know he would never have done that. But and so Washington, for example, when it came to major generals, he was forced to work with the men picked by Congress, who inevitably made political decisions that, in many cases, had nothing to do with what was the correct military thing to do.
I know, for example, Benjamin Rush was one of those people who expressed doubts about Washington and his perhaps ambitions if he was offered too much responsibility and too many accolades.
Yeah, and you know, you can understand where they came from, because Washington was quickly becoming the personage in America, and as his popularity went up, the fears that he might use this for his own personal ends increased, and that's kind of the story of America, though. You know, we've always had a Congress that is seems to be working at cross purposes with the executive, and
it's kind of
hardwired into it. These are checks and balances, and I think a lot of people think of Congress when they think of the Revolution, and they think of the writing of the Declaration of Independence, you know, of this wonderful, these leading personages, whether they be Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, banding together and penning this brilliant document, and that did happen. But soon after the independence was declared, all of those great personalities migrated away from the Continental Congress. And it became much, you know, lesser lights, and they didn't have the power really to tax the American people or really to make government work, and so it became this a very dysfunctional body that made it Washington's life very difficult when it came to running an efficient army under very deplorable circumstances.
We'll look at the personality differences between George Washington and Benedict Arnold when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Nathaniel Philbrick, who's telling us about Benedict Arnold and what made him turn traitor and what made him, in fact, become one of the most famous traitors in history. You were saying earlier, Nath, that George Washington caused fears from people who thought that he would become too ambitious, might become a military dictator, and he had the same kind of battlefield aggressiveness that Benedict Arnold had. The two must have had certain things in common, but what made them go in such different directions?
Yeah, one thing Washington had, and this is, he had what were described as passions too great for a mere man. I mean, he was truly passionate by nature. But even as a teenager, he became aware that he needed to control his anger issues, if you will. And he very famously wrote out the rules of civility in an attempt to sort of control his personality. And that's a remarkable characteristic to have, for someone to sort of step outside of themselves and look at themselves and say, this is what I need to do to be better. And Washington had that ability at a very young age, and so he could never change who he was, and that was a truly passionate person. But he was able to assert this incredible level of control that was in place most of the time. There would be times when the veneer would crack, and you would see that, but Washington succeeded in doing that. And Arnold, just that wasn't in him. He was not able to control that kind of thing. And Washington also had a tremendous amount of patience. He could listen to congressmen drone on to no purpose and pretend to at least take it. Arnold had none of that patience intact and would let people know exactly what he thought and inevitably anger someone he did not necessarily agree with. Washington had that ability to hear people out, to think about it, and to, even if he was going to make a decision that was contrary to what the person he was talking to believed, he had that ability to make them realize that he was listening to them and he was coming to a different decision because of this. And so Washington was able to work with people. Arnold was able to lead people in battle. But when it came, when he was outside the field of battle, when it came to working with congressmen, even his fellow officers in a non-combat situation, inevitably his passions would rise to the fore, civility would unravel, and all heck would break loose. Washington, kept a handle on it, and I did mention that Washington, by natural temperament, was aggressive. And in the early years of the war, he wanted to beat the British in battle. That's what he was trying to do in New York that led to his defeat there. He would fall into that same trap at Brandywine as the British tried to take Philadelphia. But after those losses, during the Washington, with the help of Major General Nathaniel Greene, who was in many ways the general upon whom he depended the most when it came to advice, he would realize that this kind of although it might give him great satisfaction to defeat the British in battle, it was too risky. Given the untrained nature of his army, he needed to be more defensive-minded, and he developed a strategy of what he called the War of Posts and became that careful, defensive-minded, pragmatic leader that he's now famous for being. And this was because Washington was able to look out beyond himself, assess the situation, and do what was not what he wanted, but was best for his country.
Now, Benedict Arnold, like many Americans, I think that would include Washington too, sacrificed a lot financially, at least early in the Revolutionary War, for the cause, did he not?
Yes, he did. When he was in Canada in those first years, a lot of his personal fortune went to supporting his army, because America had no money. You still had to feed people. You still had to, things had to function. And many officers would take loans on their own, on their own dime. And so Arnold, once he was back from Canada, made several attempts to get reimbursed by Congress. Washington, for example, was extremely methodical throughout the by personality, and would have receipts for every expense he had throughout the Revolution, all of which Congress ended up paying. Arnold was not methodical and did not have the paperwork that Congress required, and this infuriated him, and he would do his best to try to recreate that paper trail, but never to the satisfaction of Congress. And so combine that with being overlooked for promotion, and to the fact that Arnold had spent a lot of his own money in the cause and was not getting monetary satisfaction from Congress, all of this contributed to his growing dissatisfaction with how he was being recognized by his own country for the sacrifices he was giving.
Then there was the wound.
Yes. And then, you know, it would ultimately come almost exactly a year after his great performance at Valcour Island. By delaying the British from taking Fort Ticonderoga, what he had done, in retrospect, is set up what would be a year later one of the greatest victories, American victories of the Revolution, the Battle of Saratoga, which is actually two battles, the Battle of Freeman's Farm and the Battle of Bemis Heights. And Arnold would be absolutely critical to American success in those two battles. But he would be grievously injured at the very end of the Battle of Bemis Heights. And he would, after leading this incredible charge on a British redoubt, he would ride his horse between two lines of fire into the sally port, the rear entrance of the redoubt, his sword up in the air, and the German soldiers all around him who were mercenaries for the British, and he would shout, "Surrender!" One of those soldiers raised his musket, fired. The musket ball hit him in his left leg, which had already been terribly injured in Quebec a few years before. It would fracture the bones of his thigh, kill his horse, which would then collapse on top of his injured leg, and he would be pinned to the ground. And one of his officers came up to him afterwards, by which time they had taken the redoubt, and say, "Are you badly injured?" And Arnold, and this officer had been with him in Quebec, and Arnold would say, "You know, in the same leg, I wish the musket ball had gone through my heart." Because, you know, his leg was badly injured. He realized that his superior officer at Saratoga, Horatio Gates, was probably going to get most of the credit for this great victory. And, you know, what was there left?
Well, and in addition to the pain, I would think, which sounds like it was considerable, his mobility would be limited. I mean, he could not, or at least it would be very difficult for him to be the aggressive battlefield warrior if he had lost the use of one leg.
Absolutely. Arnold's physicality was everything to him. He was a true athlete. Many people commented on this. I mean, he was great. He was a great mariner, a great on a horse, you know, all of these things. And he was so badly injured, the doctors wanted to amputate the leg. He refused. He would spend several months in Albany in a hospital with his leg in what was known as a fracture box, kind of an 18th century version of a medieval torture device. And, you know, so immobilized, he couldn't even write letters. And all the time, growing increasingly bitter about his treatment by his country, by his fellow officers, about the fact that he was going to be a cripple. And he would ultimately emerge from the fracture box, unable to walk unassisted for more than a year. It would be several years before he could ride a horse. And he was a changed man after the injury suffered at the Battle of Saratoga.
So if we count these steps to treason for Benedict Arnold, we have the overlooking of his rank that he felt he deserved, his money that he wasn't getting back from Congress, and now this wound. And I suppose on the more positive side, then we encounter Peggy Shippen.
Yeah. Well, you know, just at its worst for Benedict Arnold, and what would happen is with the Battle of Saratoga, it was such a victory that France would come into the war on the side of America. It was a great development, and this forced the British to retreat to evacuate Philadelphia, which they had just taken. And because Arnold could not serve on the field of battle, Washington, as kind of favor, made him military governor of Philadelphia. And unfortunately, Philadelphia at this time, with the evacuation of the British and then the return of the Patriot half of the population, was a very divided city, where those residents who had stayed while the British were there were reviled by the Patriots who returned. I mean, it would have required a military governor of great tact and patience to keep the lid on the city, and that wasn't Arnold. And so he soon found himself in this kind of chaotic state where political officials in Philadelphia and throughout Pennsylvania were angry at him, but he fell in love. He was 36 by this 38. I'm sorry. By this time, a widower. 36. Yes, he was 36. A widower with three children, and he met 18-year-old Peggy Shippen. Peggy came from a family of Philadelphia aristocracy. They were not loyalists in outwardly, but by inclination. And in fact, Peggy and her sisters had remained in Philadelphia during the British occupation and had regularly socialized with British officers, including none other than Major John Andre, who was one of the more handsome and well-liked officers in the British Army. And Arnold was absolutely smitten by Peggy, and Peggy was absolutely smitten by Arnold, and they would be married. And within a month of their marriage, Arnold would send out his first feelers to the British, to none other than John Andre.
And now this is a more radical step than his discontent with the Americans and the way they're treating him. Now he's taken a whole different dimension to his attitude in this war.
Absolutely, and you know what's happened is he was overlooked for promotion. Congress would reinstate him give him the rank he deserved after his injury at Saratoga, but that was too late from Arnold's point of view. And he began to distrust the direction the revolution was going. If Congress was capable of doing this to him, was this a body capable of leading a country?
Assuming it even won the revolution in the first place.
Exactly, and he became increasingly convinced that the revolution was unwinnable. And he would convince himself that the greatest act of loyalty to his country would be to
restore
the British back, mm-hmm. and as bloodlessly as possible. This did not prevent him, however, from insisting that the British pay him 10,000 pounds for the privilege, which makes it hard to argue that he did this for the good of his fellow countrymen when he was being paid to turn traitor. But this is what Arnold believed. He would later say he thought there was no way we were going to win the war. Americans had lost the freedoms they had enjoyed before the revolution. It was his job as one of the leading lights of the American army to facilitate the return of the British so that peace and British freedoms, liberties, could once again be enjoyed by his fellow Americans. And so this is the mind game he went through, but it was also greatly facilitated by the fact that he married a woman who was also angered by how he was being treated by his own country and had real sympathies for the British side of things. And so, you know, the mysteries of a marriage, I think, definitely contributed to Arnold's decision to ultimately turn traitor.
I get the impression that Peggy Shippen also had sort of the natural abilities of a spy.
Yes. Well, you know, Peggy was beautiful, and she was also quite bright, energetic, and manipulative in her own way. And her father initially objected to her marriage with Arnold. And she played it beautifully when it came to getting him to finally agree to that. And it's clear when you look at the correspondence. And what's interesting is the all the papers relating to the British spy service during the revolution ended up in the papers of Henry Clinton, who became the British commander in chief at this time. And those papers are now at the Clements Library on the campus of the University of Michigan. Those papers got there only until the first half of the 20th century, and that correspondence reveals that Peggy was not just unaware of what her husband was doing. She was deeply involved, and you could argue was truly a stage manager when it came to getting her husband to finally. Because it would take more than a year after first contacting the British to finally. Make that big step.
What did he offer?
Well, this is what he offered was, since his injury limited his ability on the battlefield, but what he offered was there was this incredible fortress at West Point, and it was the potential strategic key to that waterway, and if there were 3,000 soldiers stationed there, many provisions and ammunition, and if that should go to the British, the war would very likely be over, because it was not going very well. The American people who had refused to pay taxes on British tea were now very reluctant to pay the taxes to support Washington's army, and he just did not have the ammunition, the provisions he needed to fight this war, and it was all threatening to just fall apart. And so Arnold was able to maneuver his way into being the commander at West Point. He and Peggy lived in his headquarters, a former loyalist former home, about a mile below West Point on the east bank of the Hudson River. And the plan was that in the September of 1780, the British would launch and send soldiers on ships up the Hudson River, attack the West Point, and Arnold would do everything to make sure that fortress was quickly surrendered to the British. And so that was the plan.
We're going to look at another player that we've already mentioned, the charismatic and in some ways mysterious Major John André, and how he plays a part in the treason of Benedict Arnold when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Nathaniel Philbrick, who's telling us about the steps that Benedict Arnold took from loyal American to one of the most notorious of all traitors. We've mentioned this fascinating figure, I think still ambiguous and mysterious in a lot of ways, Major John André, who was actually the link between Benedict Arnold and his wife, Peggy Shippen. They were, in a way, a little bit of a triangle, weren't they?
They were. André had known Peggy before she met Arnold. They had socialized regularly with Peggy in Philadelphia. And, in fact, there is a sketch of Peggy done by André. And she's a beautiful woman. And he was a man of many talents. Not only an artist, he acted regularly in plays that the British military would put on in their off hours, and he would write poetry. He knew a number of languages. He was handsome, and he was just one of those quintessential figures that people just seem to gravitate towards. And yet, about him, there was a kind of air of mystery and darkness. He was witness to several of, and a participant in several of the most brutal massacres of the Revolution involving American soldiers who were surprised at night while asleep. And he seems to have had no problem with these very violent encounters. And yet he was able to project this air of absolute civility and honor, gentlemanly honor. So yes, there's he is a true enigmatic figure that particularly when you pair him with someone like Arnold.
How much experience did Major André have in espionage?
He didn't initially have much at all, but you know he was a very quick learner, and he ingratiated himself quickly with Henry Clinton, the British commander in chief, who became very dependent on him, both emotionally and professionally, as he became quickly worked up his way to become the British spymaster. And and he clearly enjoyed the cloak and dagger aspect of espionage. Here they are. They've got codes. You cipher. You're even using a brush in writing with invisible ink, all of these kinds of things. This is just the kind of role that André relished, and he proved to be quite good at it.
A gentleman's game.
Yes, a gentleman's game, and it appealed to his sense of intellect. Yes, you can fight battles on battlefields, but you can also do things through deception and intelligence, so this appealed greatly to André.
So, what was the setup?
Well, the setup was this: they had corresponded back and forth for more than a year, but it wasn't until Arnold was ensconced in West Point in the summer of 1780 that things really began to come to a climax. And up until that point, André and Arnold had not yet met, this was a big operation to pull off. And Clinton wanted to make sure that there was a face-to-face meeting with Arnold before he committed his army, a good portion of the Navy, to what was a very risky operation.
But how much could they trust Benedict Arnold, for one thing?
Right. And yeah, was Arnold playing them? Was Arnold, a double agent, all of these kinds of questions. And so it was arranged that the two of them would meet on the banks of the Hudson. And you can't make this stuff up because it's September of 1780. André makes his way up the Hudson River in the most appropriately named British vessel of all time, the HMS Vulture. The Vulture works her way up the Hudson River, anchors at the end of Teller's Point, and Arnold is waiting for him in a grove of trees on the west bank of the Hudson. And at midnight, André is rowed across to this bank. They have their meeting. Arnold gives him some documents related to the security of West Point that André ultimately folds up and puts in inside his boot. And by dawn, it's time for André to be rowed back to the Vulture. When unbeknownst to Arnold, one of his officers on his own has moved a cannon to the end of Teller's Point, and as dawn erupts, so does his cannon. fires on the ship, and the Vulture is forced to retreat down the Hudson, meaning that now André has no way to get back to New York, to get back to Clinton, to tell him that the soldiers who have already been loaded into the ships should begin the assault on West Point. André is forced to spend the day in a house on the west side of the Hudson, and at night he is taken across the Hudson on a ferry to the west bank of the Hudson, and that night and at dawn the next morning, he's making his way down through what's Westchester County just north of New York. You know, this is the land of the headless horseman, of Rip Van Winkle.
Yeah.
You know, it's at this point, it was known as the neutral ground. It was where neither army held sway. It was this kind of no man's land where gangs of patriots who called themselves Skinners would fight it out with bands of loyalists who called themselves cowboys. And it was, you know, it was former neighbors literally raping and pillaging each other. It was just a horrible situation. And no one knew on whose side anyone was when they were in this part of Westchester County. And through this haunted landscape, Andre was trying to make his way to New York. It was dawn when three men stepped out of the shadows, each bearing a musket, and told him to stop. One of the men had a Hessian jacket, which led Andre to believe that he was with his side, the British. And he says, "I'm a British officer on a very important business. I must get back to New York. Let me go." And the three men say, "Wait a minute. Get down off of that horse." And as Andre would learn to his horror, these were not British or Hessians. These were patriot militiamen. And the one with the Hessian jacket had just a few days before been imprisoned in New York and had used that jacket as a way to escape. And so they searched him, found the paper, Arnold's papers on him, and began to suspect, knew that he was a spy, and this created all sorts of suspicions around Arnold. And once again, you can't make this stuff up because, as it so happened, it would take more than a day for this information to make its way up to Arnold's headquarters on the Hudson River. On the very day that none other than George Washington, Lafayette, Hamilton, and Henry Knox were due to arrive. They had just met with French General Rochambeau in Hartford, and they were about to enjoy breakfast with Arnold. Arnold was there waiting for him when he gets a message that Major John Andre had been captured. At this point, there were maybe suspicions about Arnold, but no actual proof. Arnold knows the gig is up. Goes up to his bedroom where Peggy is with their infant son and says, "I'm out of here." makes his way to the barge at the dock in front of his house and heads down the Hudson and eventually makes his way to the Vulture and Freedom and New York. Washington arrives soon after that, gets documents that inform him that not only had Andre been captured, but he had been bearing documents from Arnold, and he realizes that one of his best battlefield generals, Benedict Arnold, has attempted to betray his country. He turns to Lafayette. You know, this young French general in his early 20s has become a kind of surrogate son to Washington and says, "Whom can we trust now?"
Yes, it must have taken some real resilience on Washington's part to come back from that.
I mean, talk about a body blow. I mean, this is where the revolution is crumbling around him, and now he hears this that one of his best officers has betrayed not only him but the entire country.
So let's look at how it comes out for two of these people we've been talking about. Major John Andre is a spy, a captured spy. He may be charismatic. He may be multi-talented. He may be handsome and he may be clever, but he's still a spy in the hands of the Americans, and he's not going to be treated like a British POW then.
Right. Well, you know, Andre played the American officers, all of whom admired him in part because, you know, Andre portrayed himself as betrayed by Arnold, just as Arnold had been, you know,
betrayed
all
them.
Those American officers had been betrayed, and he was hopeful that he could garner enough sympathy that he might get out of this alive. Washington resisted all that, realized that no, this was a spy who had would insist that he would not only die not by a firing squad, but he would be hanged as the spy that he was, and this was a very difficult decision for him. that alienated, that actually, you know, angered many of his officers, particularly Hamilton.
Washington never met André Hettie.
No. Washington was smart enough to, I cannot create a personal relationship with this man. This has to be a decision that serves the good of this country. I mean, America's had been rocked to the foundations. What they needed was an expression of absolute strength and resolve. And so what he did was execute André as a spy.
And after this, once he has escaped, once Benedict Arnold is, for him at least, safely in New York among the British, what's his future?
Well, you know, he was a traitor to the Americans, but he was also a traitor in the eyes of the British. He would be awarded the rank of Brigadier General, and he would ultimately serve the British Army in Virginia and in Connecticut and serve admirably. I mean, you can argue that he was not only America's best battlefield general, he was Britain's best battlefield general as well. But, you know, there was a taint around him. And those that served under him in the British Army did not like it. And you know what? The great irony is that the outrage spawned by Arnold's treason among the American people was incredible. It had this galvanizing effect. Up until this point, it looked as if the 13 states would all go their separate ways and the revolution would simply collapse under its own weight. After Arnold's betrayal, it was as if a lightning bolt was sent throughout the country. And I don't think it's an accident that within only a year's time would come the great victory at Yorktown, in part because Arnold would be sent to Virginia. Washington would be so angered by that that he would send Lafayette down after him, ultimately, Benedict Arnold would be replaced by Cornwallis, and then would come the great victory that would deliver America its independence. So I think you could argue that, short of Washington, Arnold did, as much as anyone as an American for the cause, but it was truly as a spy, and this is the great tragic irony of his life. It is truly as a traitor that he perhaps served his country, gave the country the impetus to pull itself out of the spiral it was in and ultimately win this what seemed to be an unwinnable war.
When he settled in London for the balance of his life, was he able to succeed socially and financially?
No. It did not go well with him socially. There were several a very public social situation where he was cut dead by well-known people, British aristocrats. He would end up in Nova Scotia as a merchant attempting to make the money he felt was owed him, although he made out quite handsomely by being a trader. But he would ultimately die in debt and not a happy man. Peggy would be able to sort of work her way out of that debt, and their sons would ultimately serve with great distinction in the British military. And so, it would be a true cautionary tale where, and he has become, as you said earlier, you know, the archetype when it comes to the embodiment of a traitor.
Nathaniel Philbrick, it has been a pleasure going through the life and the times, the very difficult, troubled times of Benedict Arnold with you. Thank you for joining me.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Nathaniel Philbrick is the author of various bestsellers, but including in particular, related to this conversation, Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and The Fate of the American Revolution. I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Air.